One dead Palestinian child is too many. I get that. I do not want war in my name. And yet, here we are.
The flag was hoisted before the world.
What does it mean, fight back? We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here we are.
Here I am.
Here I am with Shai Davidai.
So I'm really excited for my next guest. She is an actor, a neuroscientist, an author, a staunch, proud Zionist. Most people or many people know her from The Big Bang Theory. I might be aging myself, but in the 1990s in Israeli TV, when we only had a few channels, Blossom was one of those shows that were on rerun every single day. So that's where I got to know you or your work. And here I am with Mayim Bialik. Hey, Mayim.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here. It's an honor to honestly to get to talk to you. You've been a huge component of so many of our lives, you know, since October 7th. So I'm really honored to get to talk to you.
So I've been really waiting for this conversation because we've never met, and there's something I need to tell you. I spoke up on Columbia's campus with that video, and you were an instrumental part of that video going viral. I did not have an Instagram account, yet you somehow got that video and posted it on your social media on Instagram with, I think, about 5 million followers. And that gave that video such huge exposure, which then led to the snowball of everything. So in a way, this conversation would not have happened if you hadn't done that. So I don't know if I want to thank you for making this happen or accuse you of ruining my personal life. but you were very instrumental. So thank you, Mayim.
I mean, I appreciate that. Like, ani margisha, like, that's very, it makes me very emotional because it's the worst thing to have to be united on, you know, to have this situation in our lives. But, you know, this is one of those times. I mean, I really had no idea about that. It just makes me very emotional because, you know, your voice was so important to so many of us. And I just felt like, you know, you said, it's not just what you said, it's how you said it. And, you know, for so long, we've had to be so measured and so this and be careful and don't offend and this, that. And I think that's what struck me. It wasn't just the words, it was the execution and the passion. And this called for that. So,
But I keep telling people,
what a strange connection.
I keep telling people, like, a voice is nothing if it's not amplified. Like, I can say whatever I want, however I want to say it. But if 15 million people hadn't seen it, and they saw it, the reason they saw it is because millions of others have shared it, mm-hmm. then that voice would have been just lost in the ether.
Well, and I think that it speaks to, and, you know, honestly, I have no idea what the course is that we're going to talk about today, you know, meaning like what we're going to get into, but, you know, there's so much conversation, especially at that time, about who's amplifying what and how. And, you know, I don't have bots. I don't have Iran on my side helping me amplify messages. I'm literally one Jew. I'm one Zionist. I'm one human who, you know, has chosen to integrate aspects of my personal and my public life. And, you know, you are that intersection. So
we're definitely going to delve into that. But before that, I start every episode with a very simple yet hard-hitting question. Mayim Bialik, what kind of a Jew are you?
Um, you know, I think of sort of some of the nomenclature that's been placed on me, right? I'm that proud Zionist Jew. I'm that in your face Jew. But, you know, if I'm, I don't know, so emotional. You know, if I'm really to answer it, I'm like, you know, I'm a mutt. I'm a conglomeration of thousands of years, you know, and I wear my Judaism on my face, meaning I am what people think of when they think of Jewish features, but also as a public person, like my identity is everyone's. So it's almost like I'm that Jew that literally is, I'm in your living room. I'm the you cannot avoid me Jew.
I love I'm that you can't avoid me Jew is great because for many years Jews in America have been those hiding Jews, those avoiding Jews, those change your last name Jews, those try not to stick out as Jews, and you kind of flip the script. Right? There's so many Jewish actors and that people don't know they're Jewish because they not out of ill will, out of self-perseverance, you know, they had to change their name, hide their identity, not keep Shabbat, not explain why they can't work on that specific day on Yom Kippur, right? And you're like, no, hey, I'm that Jew. And I'm a good
Well, and I
actor.
think, yeah, and I think also, you know, part of it, you know, our identity as Jews, as a global community, is incredibly diverse. And, you know, many people think of the Ashkenazi Jew, right? Many people think of the Woody Allen Jew. I grew up in a post-Holocaust family where that was being Jewish. We were all versions of Woody Allen. And then I went to Israel and I said, what is happening here? We are dark-skinned and swarthy. We are muscular. We have
Not
flowing black hair.
you and I, but you know.
No, not you and I. But you know, we are Ethiopian Jews. We are Jews from all parts of the world. We are Mizrahi Jews. We are, I mean, we look like all sorts of things. And yet, in Hollywood and in America, there's still this notion of like, are you passing? So people love to say, I think Jewish women are attractive. Natalie Portman, Scarlett Johansson, you know, and they name women who, of course, look Jewish because anyone can look Jewish. But when people say, does she look Jewish? Like, this is what we're talking about, you know? And so for me, that's kind of
Wait,
why, you
Mayim,
know, I once.
because not everyone will be watching this, and obviously everyone knows what you look like, but for someone listening in, when you point to your face and say like this, like what is it? What are the features that you are saying that
So,
is my Jewishness?
I mean, and again, I'd like to repeat, you know, Jews look like all sorts of things. And, you know, if you've been to Israel, if you've been part of a, you know, a Persian Jewish community or an Israeli Jewish community, you see, we look like all sorts of things. But for a lot of people in America, you know, this stereotype of the Semitic features, you know, I have a prominent nose, I have a prominent chin. Like, I got two sets of features that are prominent, right?
You
I
got
happen to
glasses?
be, I mean, I was, I'm so I wear, right now I wear glasses, but I actually do. I was blonde. I have blue eyes. You know, I'm fair. I tend to be more olivey, which is my dad's Ukrainian side. But you know, what I am is I'm Hungarian, I'm Polish, and I'm Ukrainian. And I'm an intersection of the Holocaust, tearing people from their homes and throwing them on the shores of Manhattan and seeing what happened. And what happened is people meet in night school and they meet at, you know, Jewish dances. So I'm a conglomeration, you know, of all those things. And I have, you know, a lot of people would describe me as having a Jewish body type. I'm Zaftig, I'm busty. And, you know, I'm not super tall. I do have some legs on me, but, you know, there's a lot about me that I mean, my kid once said I was auditioning for some role and one of my kids was like, oh, is the character Jewish? And my younger one said, well, you're playing it. It has to be. Like, there was no question. And part of that is like, that's my Ima, right? My Ima is Jewish and she plays parts that are Jewish. But it was more just like, I think because of some of my, you know, distinctive features, I think there's definitely a thing about that. And, you know, I'll meet Jews, and we definitely, I look like other Jews with prominent features. My partner, we joke that we look more like cousins than a happy couple.
But happy cousins. has that ever been a hindrance in your career?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I was 14 when Blossom came out, and I will never forget the first review I read. It was a writer. I don't name the journalist, and I wouldn't even if I remembered his name. But he described how distracting it was. My face. Described that I had a shield-shaped face, which some of us just call heart-shaped. And it said, I have a mismatched face of features. I was 14 years old. And in my mind, the first thing I thought was, I am mismatched because I'm Hungarian and I'm Polish and I'm Jewish and we never fit in. And my face is evidence of that, you know?
But that seems okay. So we could be having a conversation right now that has nothing to do with Jewish civil rights, has nothing to do with Zionism, has nothing to do with Israel, has nothing to do with that. No journalist should ever be writing about someone's face as distracting, especially not a woman, especially not an underage 14-year-old.
I was 14.
Girl, like.
It's a very different culture then. Also, this was, you know, 1990, 1989, which I'm not excusing it, but I'm saying like there was a vernacular
you think
that was
changed?
Very different. It's very, yeah, I think it's changed. I definitely think it's changed. And I think, you know, that's what's kind of very endearing to me about these next generations after mine, you know, women feel absolutely justified in saying like, you can't talk to me like that, which when I was 14, I never would have said that. You know, when I see young feminists, men too, who are feminists, I'm like, wow, that's amazing. You say to people, you can't talk to me that way. Wow.
So that's another part of you. You're not just a Jew and a Zionist. You are also a feminist. And
sure.
I've seen you call out anti-Semitic individuals like Linda Sarsour for saying that Zionism and feminism cannot coexist.
I mean, I was told that Judaism and feminism can't, you know, coexist. And I, you know, was a fairly observant person for most of my life. And so, yeah, I like to tackle those things for sure.
So what is the thought process of someone who says these two things cannot coexist, where clearly you and I, at least two data points, my wife will be a third data point, you know, all the feminist organizations would be all these other data points of Zionism and feminism existing?
I mean, I think there's a larger systemic mechanism behind the denigration of Zionism, you know, that I saw as a student. At UCLA, I did my undergraduate and my graduate work at UCLA, and it was the beginning echoes of this Zionism campaign that we now see what it has grown into. But yeah, I think that's what is behind that is, I mean, this is my opinion, but to me, that's a way of continuing the marginalization and the legitimization of the Jewish people. So that any place that we try and fit in, any place that we try and assimilate, any place that we try and do what we've done for thousands and thousands of years, which is to maintain our individuality while also being part of a universal, larger community. It's what we've had to do for thousands of years, and we do it pretty well by all measures. But that kind of statement is, to me, it's, you know, I'm picturing like a cheese grater. It's trying to grate us out of the place that we are allowed to exist. And, you know, my evidence when people would say, how can you be a religious Jew and also be a feminist? I would say, because I am, meaning there are ways that I think about it, understand it, make it work, make accommodations, don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Like, it exists because we exist. It's not this abstract thing that you get to take from me because of your desire to delegitimize my existence as a Jew or a Zionist.
But when you called out Linda Sarsour, you basically said, I don't have to choose between
Correct.
Being a Zionist, meaning a Jew who refuses to denounce her identity, and being a feminist. And I think that's the problem, that when they portray Zionism is opposed to feminism, Zionism mm-hmm. is racism, Zionism is this, Zionism is that, they are forcing people to choose
yep.
between, like, do I stand with this identity of mine or that identity of mine?
Well, and it's a well calculated approach, because if given the choice, and this is actually one of the original conversations I started having in the public arena regarding Zionism. If given the choice, do you want to be a good person or do you want to be this term, right? That's kind of what it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, do you want to be a person who believes in the rights of Black people or do you want to be a Zionist, right? And that kind of, you know, makes your head start to rattle. Like,
right,
what do you mean?
You're given a false dichotomy and...
It is absolutely, absolutely a false dichotomy. And the first time that I chose to speak up about Zionism and introduce the millions of people that I can reach with the definition of Zionism as the belief in the Jewish people's right to an autonomous state in our homeland of Israel, I introduced the term because I was being attacked for being a Zionist. People protested a talk that I gave in the middle of the Midwest. It was not a talk about Judaism, wasn't even hosted by the Hillel. I was speaking at a university, and in the middle of my talk, a group shows up.
Do you remember what you were speaking about?
Yeah, it was like a talk about like my academic history, you know, being a child actor and how I went on to get a PhD in neuroscience. It was like a generic, Mayim Bialik gets paid to come speak to university students. It's fun. Everybody comes. We don't even charge for tickets. Have a great time. 1,000 people in the audience.
Sounds very objectionable.
It was very, well, I think we all know what was objectionable, right? So
but you know what, for people that don't know, spell it out. What was objectionable?
Yeah. So a group came in during the talk and started protesting and screaming. And I saw the flyers afterwards that were handed out to announce that there was going to be a meeting and a protest of me. It said, Mayim Bialik is a Zionist. And I looked at the flyer, and this was several years ago. I looked at the flyer and I thought, well, this is strange. Since when do you call a protest for someone believing that Israel has a right to exist? This seems crazy. And when I saw what was happening online, I saw that fans of mine were starting to post, because these groups started infiltrating my social media, and fans of mine were saying, Mayim Bialik is a wonderful person. She would never be a Zionist. And I thought, what? That's like a record scratch. And that's when I realized that the nomenclature surrounding my identity had been hijacked. And I'm not going to say by who. I mean, I think we all know kind of a larger picture of what's happening several years later. But I started realizing unassuming, uneducated people are thinking that the word Zionism means fascist, it means Nazi, it means hater. It was being used interchangeably with things that Zionism does not mean. So that was the first time that I said, hey, everybody, it's come to my attention that a lot of people don't know what the definition of Zionism was. And I think back to that Mayim Bialik, I was very naive. I was very naive, because I thought if I explained it and I said, hey, Zionism is just the belief that we have the right to exist. Everybody get it? I thought that would do it.
But I actually think that in a way it is naive, because what you and I refuse to accept is that they oppose that. They oppose the belief that we have a right to exist as a
Correct.
Community. They're
Correct.
Okay with Mayim Bialik as a Jew who will be a Jew and in her home. But once Mayim Bialik is of the Jewish people, she exists as a community, and that is opposable to them.
And what it reveals is a darker, deeper truth that I was raised to hope was paranoia. My grandparents fled Eastern Europe during the pogroms leading up to the Holocaust. They lost their entire families. And I was raised resisting that they didn't like us, right? That happened then. It's not going to happen again. Never again, right? Mm. We even hashtagged it. So what I didn't want to understand, which, you know, I still, you know, when I was at UCLA also, I was part of a lot of intellectual conversations that we had with the Muslim Student Association, that we had with the African Student Union, that we had with, you know, the Armenian organization, the Mexican Chicano organization. We were part of a lot of conversations about where did the Jews belong that previously had never been an issue. And I was at UCLA in the late 90s, and it was the first that we were seeing of Zionism as racism. And, you know, what I knew was that, and like Sam Harris, who was a colleague of mine at UCLA, what Sam Harris has talked about is there was still an intellectual academic argument that I was willing to engage in about the borders of the definitions of Zionism as distinct from the Jewish people. Mm-hmm. And all of that changed on one day. And that day was October 7th. And there is no longer confusion for me about what the anti-Zionism movement is. There's no longer confusion on the reactions that occurred, based on what you articulated. There's no more, I'm not confused anymore.
But what I think a lot of people still are, Jews and many non-Jews who are listening, and hopefully more will be listening. Walk me through that thought process. Like, what was the confusion? What did you see on October 7th? What is the clarity now?
So the confusion for me, and again, I'm speaking as a layperson, like I have a minor in Hebrew and Jewish studies, and I had to study, you know, a lot about the history of Israel, and also, you know, most of my family that exists is in Israel. So I've also grown up with family. I have family that live in the Shtachim, that live deep in the West Bank. They are religious Zionists. And I have family that are secular kibbutzniks. I've got everybody in between, you know, and they're all over the country. So, you know, I've also added a lot of information, meaning besides what I studied academically and what we were told in, you know, my synagogue, which honestly was not the whole story, right? So for me, once I learned more about the years leading up to 1947 in particular and 1948, what I understood is that there was a large conversation that many Jews in America in particular had been left out of about the formation of the Jewish state and what it meant for the Arab population. That's just true. So for me, I was willing to learn about that. I was learning to engage on that in the same ways that, you know, we as a Jewish population acknowledged and understood the Armenian genocide, right? And at UCLA, we would do events with that community to show that we have camaraderie. I always was trying to understand, quote, the other side. And it's not, I don't like to think of it as sides. I was trying to understand our cousins, right?
Yeah.
The people who, according to, you know, our liturgy, are our cousins.
Yes.
You know, we're all children of Abraham, right? And this isn't a religious conversation, but I'm saying colloquially, I think of it, right?
I mean historically, there's a relationship there. It's not a warm relationship, but there's a relationship nonetheless.
100%. But also, you know, I've spent time in Ramla. I've spent time in parts of Israel where, you know, most of the community was Arab. And I went into those shops. I ate in those restaurants. I ate unbelievable hummus that rivaled my favorite hummus in Jerusalem, right? Those are communities that have had to exist, and in many cases, you know, have existed. So for me, before October 7th, there was still somewhat in the back of my mind of like, okay, there may be people who are like threading this needle of Zionism as, you know, the collective, what is referred to as the occupation, right? And I'm thinking, gosh, when I say I'm a Zionist, I don't mean I believe in occupying people. I don't mean apartheid. I don't mean all those things. And that's not even saying that I agree with those assessments, but I was willing to engage that there is this threading of the needle. And I want to learn what I can learn so that I better understand your pain and so that we can build something together. And I'm not an Israeli citizen, but I am part of a global Jewish community, and I've always felt very, very connected and a very meaningful connection to Israel. I also know that if I'm not a voting person, I should probably shut my mouth when it comes to a lot of things. And I'm glad that my family kind of helps me reason that out. But October 7th, even that changed. Because what I came to realize, even before we went into Gaza, what I came to realize is that the word Zionist can be replaced with Jew by pretty much every single organization I have seen use that term in this context. And when they say, and I'm using they, whoever the they is, when they say, we don't want Zionists here, I no longer am pretending that that means anything but we don't want Jews here.
But they will say, and I completely disagree, but, you know, an anti-Zionist would say, we have Jews here. It's it's your kind of Jews that we don't want. Forget the fact that 95% of Jews are Zionists. Forget the fact that 99.9% of Zionists are Jews, right? Just that mere correlation is a correlation that you and I as scientists would love to get in any research, right?
Sure.
Forget all of that. But they would say, no, we have Jews, right? Like, just like versus blacks for Trump, right? Versus we have our Jews.
That's true.
You know, so you can't replace the word Jews with Zionists. We're saying Zionists. It's the Z word, not the J word.
Right. So that variety of Jew is absolutely what it means. And the fact is, you know, do I believe there's a place for Jews to say, we don't support what the Israeli government has done? Yes, there's a place for that. Do I believe that there's a place for Jews who say, not in my name, I don't want war in my name? Of course there's a place for that. Do I believe there's a place for Jews who say, I believe that this is an occupation, this is apartheid? Yes, there's room for everybody to believe all the things that they want.
People are allowed to be stupid. I mean,
you said that, not me.
Yeah.
But the terms of engagement for being part of a larger community, I believe, ultimately will not favor Jews on that side of the tent, because the conditions for which you are accepted are very specific. And it means denouncing a specific aspect of global Jewish identity, which is liotam chofshi be'artzenu, which is to be an autonomous, free nation in our land. It says nothing about how many states. It says nothing about the treatment of Palestinians. It is simply a definition. So I understand that there are Jews part of that movement. And again, that's completely fine. Like, our tent is big enough for all of that. I believe when it comes down to it, which many of us saw with Black Lives Matter, and many of us saw with the women's movement surrounding this, when the rubber hits the road, I do not believe you are welcome there. And I marched with a pussy hat, and I marched for Black Lives Matter. I was that Jew. And I still believe in what I marched for. And it pains me that my Republican conservative Jewish friends said to me, serves you right. We knew you shouldn't support feminism. We knew you shouldn't support Black Lives Matter. And you know what? I don't believe that. I was raised by first-generation American civil rights activists who had sit-ins to allow Black students into the public school system of New York. I was raised by true liberals who could tolerate other people's opinions. And it's okay to believe in peace over war. 100% it's okay. I get it. For some people, one dead Palestinian child is too many. I get that. I do not want war in my name. And yet, here we are.
So I would say, you know, for a lot of people who, like you and me, are very aligned on many values, forget positions, you know, many values, and people that are now beating themselves for marching with the Women's March, marching with Black Lives Matter. I say, I do not regret for a second the reasons I marched. Mm-hmm. I regret all the time the people I marched with. And that's a different thing. Because I believe that the people I was marching with were there out of their human values and not out of their virtue signaling. And if they change their values when the victims are Jews, then it shows that it wasn't a core value. It was just a way to signal, I am with this cause or whatever.
And that's devastating. That's a place of grief. Like, that is a place for me of communal grief. And what it feels like is exactly what I didn't want to believe, which is that the only people who will look after us is us. And so, it feels very fatalistic, you know? But, you know, once you post pictures of Hamas paragliders and you declare them freedom fighters on October 7th and October 8th, the conversation is over. And if you'd like to take that back, if you would like to course correct, there's a huge alphabet out there you can pull from to put all the letters together to make all the words, and the words make a paragraph. And it's about three sentences. And I have not seen that from any of these places that I have aligned with.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. But it's clear that you experienced a lot of shock. I think that I've experienced a lot of shock too, a lot of surprise, being caught off guard. But there's something about your family history that surprises me that you're surprised. So and this is me being like a weird fanboy. Like, beyond you being in the Big Bang Theory, beyond you being in Blossom, you are the great, great, great niece of Chaim Nachman Bialik, the poet laureate of Israel, who wrote the poem In the City of Slaughter about the pogroms. Mm-hmm. How did we, you know, if you just take a look at your family story, how did you go from the person who's like, hey, I'm going to tell the entire world how they slaughtered Jews, to the person's surprise that the entire world doesn't care if they slaughtered Jews?
I mean, I think you may have included one generation too many. I think there was too many greats there.
He was just a great poet, so, you know.
Right, exactly. I think there's many answers to that. You know, my Tante Feige of blessed memory, who survived the war by hiding as a Gentile in Budapest. She ended up escaping after the war. And she became very religious, like Black Hat religious, like Brooklyn religious. And I sometimes wonder if I had been raised more religious, if it would have more been part of my consciousness. That's just like it's a vague, fantasy, like in one iteration of my life. Like, was it because my parents were bohemian hippies and we kind of, they left formal Judaism and I kind of had to refine it, and I'm, technically a Baal Tshuva. Was that it? I don't know. I think a lot of what happened in the diaspora is you have to forget. There's a level of, there's a level of comfort. I was raised in Los Angeles. I went to public school. Most of the kids in my classes were, children of immigrants from Central America, from Mexico, from Korea. There was a handful of white kids, and the place that I met Jewish kids was, in synagogue. So a lot of my identity, I was really passing, I was passing as a person who didn't have to think much about it. I knew about, obviously, the Holocaust, but yeah, I think part of that was knowing that it's never going to happen again, and it couldn't happen again, right?
It's so interesting.
And I think that's it's a bit of cognitive dissonance, but also I don't want to raise my children with this kind of cynical paranoia and fear. And I also don't want October 7th to be the determining factor of how I frame being Jewish, right? It's an enormous component, but there's a lot more to our Jewish identity, of course, whether we're religious or not.
Well, in fact, I would say that you and many others in right now are actually completely changing the story. You know, going back to the Chaim Nachman Bialik, you know, and the poem In the City of Slaughter, he talks about the Jews being slaughtered with trembling knees, concealed and cowering, sons of Maccabees. And many people don't know that the term trembling knee, I'm not that Jew with trembling knee, but Begin told Biden in order to show him, like, we are not asking for your help. We will fight for our survival. That comes from the description of the Jews being massacred. And you definitely are not a Jew with trembling knees. Like, the way that you are, the amount of hate that you are experiencing out there, and yet you are calling out your colleagues for not wearing anything like a yellow pin for the hostages in the Oscars, right? You are reading, you know, final text messages of people massacred on October 7th. You're doing all those things. You are changing the story in some way.
I mean, I appreciate that. You know, I also want to clarify, it's not like I believed that everybody loved Jews. I was raised with a very healthy dose of, there's a lot of animosity. I mean, I've experienced what they now call microaggressions, right? My whole life, it still happens, right? So it's not like I was kind of, you know, bumbling along like everything's great. I know what percentage of the United States we are. I know what percentage of the world we are. And I know a lot about the historical tropes that keep surfacing. And I also know what happens when countries are in peril and when they want someone to blame. Like, I understand sort of like the scope of sort of historical anti-Semitism. I think that just to, you know, to underscore, I did not realize how hard it would be for people we otherwise assumed were allies to denounce the massacre on October 7th. I did not realize how crafty Iran and its proxies would be in utilizing a technology that did not exist until very recently to amplify propaganda, lies, and insanity, and inhumanity and dehumanization, right? That was the extent that I think the real shock kind of came for me. And in terms of, you know, the trembling knees, you know, I as a person of faith, you know, we say that we kind of tremble in awe, right, before something divine. And October 7th did not change my concept of faith, you know, any more than learning about the Holocaust did, right? This is the world that man has created, and woman. And we're all in, you know, sort of a, you know, a divine matrix, right? But I will say that there's a certain amount of, you know, clarity for me that that came on October 7th. And I'm not comparing myself to Queen Esther. I would never do that. But the notion that we never know why we are placed where we are placed at the time that we are placed there, we don't get to know. And
I mean, but
I wanted to do more.
I would say I would Dvar Torah with Shai Davidai. I would say, you know, the difference between Queen Esther and you, because I would not be saying you're Queen Esther, is that Queen Esther was put there by her uncle, Mordechai. She did not choose to be like, I am going to talk and say things.
Yeah, women weren't choosing much in those days. It's true.
You are choosing. Yes. You know, let's take that moment where you You went online on October 9th and to your 5 million followers on Instagram recited Shema Yisrael. Or a few days later, where you go and you went and you read the final text messages of someone who was executed by Hamas. That is a choice. And you're rising up to that choice. How are you doing that? And why are not more people who in Hollywood who are, I would assume, financially okay, they have enough work, why are they not doing that?
I mean, my academic answer is because the propaganda machine has worked. In that, there is such tremendous lack of moral clarity surrounding this issue in particular. There is such a lack of moral clarity. And we also, you know, live in an era of like real, I mean, black and white thinking to this degree, where there is no way to hold the suffering of one people while also holding the suffering of another people. That's a failure, you know, of the technological age that we're living in and the cultural age that we're living in. And I you know, I say that as, you know, I'm a real misanthrope. Like, I love humanity and I really dislike people, you know, a lot of the time. Meaning that's really the inability to hold complexity and nuance. And I'm not blaming cell phones and social media, but in that arena, there is no room for nuance. There is no room for understanding. So when you ask me why, that's partly why I know what I'm up against. I'm up against Iran. I'm up against the proxies of a regime that have spent the last at least 30, 60, 80 years garnering support for a denigration and a delegitimization of the Jewish people, specifically through the utilization of Israel. Why I do it is because it is a Kiddush Hashem, because I give my life to figuring out why I'm here. It's not to get awards. I've also never won an Emmy. I've been nominated 5 times. So clearly God has different plans for me. That's not why I'm here. I'm not here to, you know, be a size 4 on the red carpet. Like, why am I here at this time? Why did I experience this? That's why, because my knees are trembling in awe of our existence and our capacity to hold the suffering of more than one thing at once.
Wow. I mean, my knees are trembling in awe of our existence is, I'm going to insist, will be the title of this episode. And of course, Achi and the other producers are going to say,
"Should we get matching tattoos?"
Yeah. I'll get it if you get it. But and you know that I'm good for it. So, but here's what I want to say. And I think you're absolutely right about the propaganda machine. And like, I've never had someone explicitly say, "I feel or I know that I am up against a regime." Because, you know, I do a lot of homework when I prepare for these conversations, because I got this really great advice from Stephen Dubner, who's, you know, a journalist, a podcaster, and ask him, how do you do it? And he said, the more prepared you are, the easier it is to be spontaneous. And I saw this thing that Newsweek wrote about the reaction to you reading out the final text messages of someone from October 7th. And forget about the fact that no one who is focusing, a Palestinian who is focusing on their pain at that moment, would never be asked, why are you focusing on your pain? Why are you not focusing on both sides' pain? So that already is the double standard where you know, reeks of anti-Semitism. But here's how Newsweek describes it. It says, it stated that you divided opinion by sharing, and I quote, the final messages of a victim of the Hamas attack on Israeli settlements. October 7th, there was not even a single attack on an Israeli settlement.
Uh-huh.
All of the attacks were within the 1967 borders that are agreed upon in the entire community. It was in kibbutzim, mm-hmm. not in settlements. It was in Sderot, which is a city, mm-hmm. you know, 20, 45 minutes from Tel Aviv. Like, the idea that Newsweek and a journalist in Newsweek will call it a settlement, that the editor of Newsweek will let that slide, that the chief editor would not even notice, and that none of their readership would come and say, hey, wait, you are not just falling for the propaganda, you are actually helping perpetuate the prop. You are doing Iran's job for it. Mm-hmm. Filled me with so much dread. Mm. Because if we're up against it in Newsweek magazine, mm-hmm. that is typically devoted to, here's what housewives should see in the next season, you know, and here's how to make the best mojito. And here
I mean, look, I mean, there's a couple aspects to this. The first is the most disturbing, which is that the implication, and it's not an error when it is stated elsewhere, the implication and the direct message is that all of Israel is not legitimate. Like, to me, that's yeah. what that means. So when people talk about from the river to the sea, look at a map. Find a map where Israel is still on it, because apparently sometimes it's not always there. That to me, and I'm not like, I don't want to get into like, oh, is that slogan legit? Is it okay? What I'm saying is, if you even conceptually believe that there is a justification for crossing into those kibbutzim, then you do not believe that Israel has legitimacy. I mean, that's just, so that's like number one. Number two is another great loss and a place of grief is in the, for me, what has been the collapse of understanding where I get information. And for a long time, many of us, you know, I was raised on the New York Times, like more important than the Chumash, like more important than Torah was the New York Times. My father read it every single day. He sat with me. My hands would get black from the print. I learned to read from the New York Times. I learned to analyze things from the New York Times. I lived and died by that New York Times, right? And over the last many years, I slowly stopped seeing a place for me in the news resource I used. I read Harper's. I've noticed that there's a lot in the Harper's community that is no longer for me because of the way that they present the information going on.
I am going to say that you're absolutely right, but I think you're getting the language right. It's not that there's no play, nothing there for you. It's
right.
that you are not there for them. Like, they don't need you there. They are carving right. well, space so, without you rather than you
right.
not
well,
finding
but
yourself.
I think that that has been a real place of confusion for me as a liberal Zionist, because I used to have places I could go. And now it's kind of like, there's an aspect of the left. It's not all of the left. There's an aspect of the left that's like, you're not left enough. What do you mean, Zionism, right? And then the right, which is never a place that I kind of identified with, is a little bit like, come to our side. We got you, right? We'll tell you what news to read. And honestly, it's not liberal enough for me. I believe in the dignity and self-determination of the Palestinian people. I believe that suffering is not what the God of my understanding would want. I believe that it is a tremendous humanitarian tragedy what is occurring, and no one can dispute that. I don't believe kill them all and let God decide. That's not me. So it leaves me in this place of like, I don't I don't turn to Newsweek, right? And when Ben Stiller published his editorial, which I think was in Time, it was incredibly powerful. Why didn't more people not talk about that, right? And I was grateful that they published it. I didn't know where Ben Stiller's beautifully written piece would go. But this is another aspect of this sort of problem. I don't know where to go to find, I mean, I reach out to my Israeli family to try and understand. And my religious Zionist family has a very particular perspective. So you're going to get that. But
your secular Zionist family has a different perspective.
Has a different perspective. But I think also what's, you know, the next level of paranoia, which I feel comfortable talking about with you, is like, you know, I get a lot of my Israel news from the Free Press, which is Barry Weiss. I don't agree with everything Barry Weiss publishes. I don't agree with everything on the Free Press, but I've at least found a place where I don't feel crazy for saying, does anybody see what's happening here with media? Does anyone see what's happening with who's being placed in charge of editorial decisions? Does anyone think it's odd that certain reporters are posting very specific things about Jews and then are allowed to make the decisions about what news gets distributed to the American people? Does anyone think that's disturbing?
Yeah. I think the media
university, sorry, before I forget, like to speak to your world, it has infiltrated universities.
Well, I would
and,
say
and that's it's and it, it's worse. It just has. That's not my belief. It's well, just true.
It's actually I would say it's the opposite. It infiltrated the New York Times from universities. Where look at the editorial board, look at the journalists. Where did they go to school? You know, where were they trained? They were trained in the universities under these professors, you know. Look at it's so you know, it's so easy to see, like, the if you read the New York Times, all is good in Columbia University. And that's only because one journalist, and unlike you, I do name names, Sharon Otterman, who I've spoken with multiple times and never has she included even one of my quotes in her stuff, because it does not fit the narrative that she's trying to tell.
It does not fit the narrative. And also another thing that October 7th changed for me is I'm no longer afraid to be seen as paranoid. I'm no longer afraid of that. My whole life, I was afraid to be accused of being paranoid because my grandparents were paranoid. You know, my grandmother would cry if you even asked anything about what happened before Ellis Island, right? We didn't talk about it.
You know what they called, what do they call Jews that were paranoid in the 1930s? Alive.
What? Yeah.
But let's talk about, you know, there's fighting against, but then there's fighting for. So I want to talk a little bit about Jewish pride. You are producing a film. Tell me about Yeshiva University's The Maccabees.
So, you know, I've always
and full disclosure, the Achi Adamit and Abby Sophia, the producers of this show, both graduates, alums of Yeshiva University, and I believe met there. So in a way, this show was, you know, was created at least in part at Yeshiva University years ago.
So, so the truth is, you know, as an actor, I've always been very interested in Jewish projects. I've always gravitated towards that. You know, when I was younger, I wanted to play Hedy Lamarr, you know, who's a very famous American actress who also, you know, devised some really, really unbelievable, you know, spy technology that was used during World War II. And, you know, I had all these sort of like dreams of that. And unfortunately, you know, the industry is very specific. The Hollywood industry is very specific about what they want their Jewish actresses to look like, what they want their Jewish projects to be. So I never really kind of found, unfortunately, my place there, but very grateful for, you know, the career that I've had. And I also was in academia for 12 years and I had two kids outside of the acting world. So, you know, I've lived a very full and exciting life. But I do have a small production company. It's called Sad Clown Productions. And we have the rights to, you know, this, what we think is a very uplifting story about the basketball team at Yeshiva University. And, you know, I think the question right now, you know, and what we have is we have a director and we have a writer, but, you know, it's getting funding, it's getting distribution, it's figuring out how to make that happen. Because honestly, I don't know what stories to tell right now. I'll be super honest. You know, as a creative person, as a performer, you know, I don't know what kind of Jews people are comfortable with. I don't know what feels, I don't know. And I'm saying, I don't know. I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I'm not saying we're not welcome. I'm saying, I don't know. I'm still figuring out. Do I believe this would be a beautiful story of like a very quirky, you know, and sports, you know, related, assessment of Jewish identity that a lot of people don't think about? Yes. I also have the rights to Lemony Snicket's The Latke Who Wouldn't Stop Screaming. Real Lemony Snicket is actually, he's an author, he's a Jewish person. And so I have the rights also to a beautiful Hanukkah Christmas story for animation at Warner Brothers. So, you know, I have a lot of fun projects that do kind of revolve around this Jewish stuff. But, you know, to answer your previous question a couple questions ago, like, why don't people speak up? Because we don't know. We don't know what the industry feels about people who are this vocal.
So I will tell you,
Gal Gadot, you know, can't play a queen without, you know, a boycott, right?
There
is a price to pay, you know.
Of course, there is always a price to pay. But for me, fighting for Jewish civil rights is we tell our story and without caring who will listen.
True.
We tell our story. And because when I saw you having the rights to a story about the Yeshiva University, the Maccabees, which, by the way, went on a historic 50-win run, which has never happened in their division, not just for Jewish, but for any basketball player. And I saw you, who I wouldn't peg as a basketball player, maybe a fan.
I'm a huge sports fan.
Huge, but I was like, if this movie gets made, and I know a lot of movies don't get made at the end, but if this movie gets made, then a 10-year-old Jewish kid will sit and watch that movie, and their story will be told. So I don't care if anyone else would be seeing that movie.
No,
now, of course,
that's
idealistic because you need money, you need an audience. I get
exactly,
it.
Exactly, right. There's just like, there's practicalities. And look, the fact is there's also a ton of incredible documentaries being produced about October 7th. And, you know, that hasn't been where I've been particularly pulled just because I, like I said, I don't know, you know, I spend a lot of my time taking care of my kids and, figuring out life. I mean, you know, the world changed for us on October 7th, and there's degrees to which people feel that. And I think as a public person, I do feel it differently because as much as I've done, you have to understand that's 1/100th of what I want to do, of what I want to post.
Of course.
I'd be posting all day long if you let me, right? And I'm not saying anyone's telling me not to, but you know, what's an important component of my presence as a public person is there's a lot of people who can preach to the choir, and that's wonderful. Meaning, I love seeing celebrities posting things and getting people, you know, feeling great. If I have an opportunity to speak to people who don't even know the definition of Zionism, I'm going to speak to them a little bit differently so that I can maintain a certain aspect of an audience with the potential to educate. So when I post things, the reason I posted you is because this is something that has not been seen before or said before. It is unique. It is novel. That's the kind of thing that I want to get behind and try and amplify. You know, Hen Mazig is another person who I'm like, everything he says, I want to just like retweet it, right? Like he's so articulate, right? But I do not want to flood people, not because I'm worried about their feelings. That's not what it's about. Social media is a tool. And the reason we know that is that it's being used against the Jewish people. So if it is a tool, how do I use it in the best way to communicate important, novel information that hasn't been said before? And not simply to amplify as an expression of my hurting heart. And I'm not criticizing anybody who's posting all day. Whatever people want to do, great. For me, knowing the audience that I have and the opportunity that I have to reach non-Jews, non-Zionists, people who might literally not understand what's going on, that's what I'm trying to do. And that's why your perspective was something that it's like, yes.
It.
And does everyone hear his voice breaking? It's because his heart is broken. That's what we amplify. the humanity of our experience.
Yeah, and we need more people like you. We need, I want to be heard by everyone, not by every Jew. I never I never planned to be a voice of the Jews. I've always planned to be a voice of my son and daughter. And I want the voice of my son and daughter to be heard by everyone. So to end this off, I always end every episode with what I call the Jewish lightning round, a series of questions. There's no right or wrong answer. Just give me the first answer if it comes to mind.
Oh, no.
You get one pass, and I get to decide whether you get that pass.
Okay.
Mayim Bialik, what is one thing people don't know about you?
I have very low self-esteem. Very low. Exceptionally low. Lower than you would think.
I think that people don't know that about me either. What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
We're Giborim. We're mighty. We're a mighty people.
What is your favorite curse?
My mama Lashon is Yiddish. My parents used to call me a Katzenkopf. If I did something stupid, that means head like a cat.
Wait, a Katzenkopf?
Katzenkopf. Head like a cat.
That is not a curse, but you are too adorable for me to say that. You know, it's like, I'll take it. When was the last time you cried?
In this interview. I mean, I cried a couple times this morning taking my son to school because he was in a very grumpy mood and it really hurt my feelings. But honestly, connecting with you and hearing that I had anything to do with amplifying your message was, yeah, definitely. Yeah. It brought me to tears.
Yeah. Sorry, okay. If you could have any person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, who would that be?
I mean, the first person I thought of was Yitzhak Rabin. That's the first person I thought of.
That is a great person.
Our Hillel Center at UCLA is named for Yitzhak Rabin.
Yitzhak Rabin, the Prime Minister of Israel, the left-leaning Prime Minister of Israel, who was assassinated during the peace talks to establish a Palestinian state that will coexist next to a Jewish-Israeli state.
Mm-hmm. You'll need a lot of whiskey. Real hoot.
You need a lot of whiskey and kiddish. Cigarettes. What's your favorite Jewish holiday?
Well, I'm going to be honest. I really, really get a lot out of Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av.
What's your least favorite?
I'm that kind of Jew.
Yeah. What's your least favorite Jewish holiday?
I mean, you know, I feel like Tu B'Shvat, like it doesn't really do much for me personally. Mm-hmm. But I don't like not like it.
You just don't like trees.
I know. It's like I love trees, but like that's a holiday that sort of just gets like, you know what? I'm going to go ahead and say Lag BaOmer, but that's when we do an Upshurnish. So that's when we cut our boy's hair. So I guess I transformed a holiday that really didn't have a lot of significance for me into when you cut your child's hair for the first time.
When do you feel safest?
When I'm unconscious, like super asleep, not dreaming.
When do you feel least safe?
I felt really scared after October 7th that I would be assaulted because I wear my Jewish on my face and I'm Mayim Bialik.
And around your neck you have.
But we didn't know what was going to happen. And I had this very, and I don't, you know, I had to call my security company and they're like, I don't think that'll happen. And I was like, have you not seen what my social media looks like? I hadn't felt that kind of fear of really, I isolated I was afraid. I was very afraid, and I was afraid for my children.
What gives you hope?
The state of Israel, because they cannot do to us what they did to us before, because we have a state and we have an army. We have a government, and it may not work the way I want, but we have a process by which we can exist, and that is Hatikva. Yeah.
What is the first thing that comes to mind when you think of Jewish civil rights?
Abraham Joshua Heschel. My younger son has his name as his middle name. He marched alongside the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And my Rav, Rabbi Chaim Seidler Feller, who was our Hillel rabbi at UCLA for 40 years, you know, he taught me that you can pray with your feet, like Rabbi Heschel did. And there are things that we can fight for as Jews, which affirm our identity as Jews. They don't take away from our identity when we acknowledge the suffering of others. There's no limit to compassion.
Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel or across the Jewish diaspora. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
You know, there's too many places in Israel that need help to pick one, but I believe donating to the Hostages Forum to provide, practical and psychological support to the families of hostages and to the hostages when, God willing, they are returned. That's a place that I hope people will donate. They do beautiful work. I've gotten to go to some events where they come here in Los Angeles, and it's literally the families, and no one should know that pain. But we're all learning to.
I can't believe it's been almost a year as we're recording this.
Yeah. There's a sense of dread, you know, there's a real sense of dread. I can't believe we've been in a war this long, and I've lived through other wars. I remember the Second Intifada. I remember being afraid to walk down Ben Yehuda because you didn't know if you'd be blown up. I remember the Sparrow. I remember Cafe Bialik in Tel Aviv. We've been through other wars, and this one is, it's unreal. It's unreal.
Maim, where can people find you?
Wherever you look. I'm Miss Maim on Instagram. I have a mental health podcast called Maim Bialik's Breakdown, where we talk about all the things that impact well-being, and that's on my YouTube channel. So you can find me at YouTube at Maim Bialik, and I'm still on Facebook. I have a reach of, you know, about 10 to 15 million. We have 50 million downloads for our podcast. So thank God I have the ability to be found a lot of places.
Great. So my only complaint is that we had to do this virtually rather than in person, which is also gives me a little bit of hope because you're not off the hook and one day you'll have to meet me in person. But thank you so much for being here with me. And it gives me such great pleasure to say, so here I am with Maim Bialik.
I really appreciate it. I was very nervous because I didn't know, you know, what it would be like to kind of talk to you. I didn't know what would be asked of me, but I've never spoken this way about October 7th. And this felt like a healthy and safe place to do that. I know you may not like praise, and you're welcome to edit this out.
But thank you.
I want to tell you from the bottom of my heart, thank you for being a human. And whatever led to your being able to articulate something that had not been articulated at the time and the way that you did it, I thank your parents. I thank your ancestors, because everything led to you being Shai Davidai and being able to communicate what you did.
And my wife, Yarden Greenspan, is 50% of everything
I
do.
Because you gave voice to something, and it's no small thing. So thank you. And one of my closest friend's sons is at Columbia, so I'd love to give a shout out to him when we stop recording.
Because
she's reached out to you. We'd love for you to look after our Dylan.
I will do. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."